On this, the 10th anniversary of the publication of Stone Butch Blues, I've just finished reading the novel for the first time. Does that sound odd to you? I wrote this narrative from the inside, awash in its depths, towed by its currents. By the time I held the blues in my hands, the inked words seemed like faint animal tracks on a smooth landscape, a cold trail I couldn't follow. Now, a decade later, I am surprised, astonished, to be reintroduced to characters I birthed, who, like anyone's grown children, develop fictional lives of their own, independent of mine. I discover a journey not identical to my life's path, and yet blazed with the intimate familiarity of my own lived experience. I locate theory, the way it is lived in motion and in interconnection, not hard to understand, hard to live. And I feel the heat of the inextinguishable fire of resistance to oppression. Like my own life, this novel defies easy classification. If you found Stone Butch Blues in a bookstore or library, which category was it in? Lesbian fiction? Gender studies? Like the germinal novel The Well of Loneliness by Radcliffe/John Hall. This book is a lesbian novel and a transgender novel, making trans genre a verb as well as an adjective. Is it fiction? I'm frequently asked. Is it true? Is it real? Oh, it's real, all right. So real it bleeds. And yet it is a remembrance. Never underestimate the power of fiction to tell the truth. When Stone Butch Blues was published, I thought I would keep cartons of copies in my closet to give out to people who were ready to read it. But this book, like the movements for social change it inextricably connected with, exploded the closet door off its hinges. Since then, I've received the gift of hundreds of thousands of letters, emails, and phone calls, heartfelt emotions shared by individuals I've met at rallies, universities, colleges. I've been stopped by strangers in places from a gas station in rural Iowa to a shopping mall in Jersey City. These people, many of whose lives' battles do not seem to be related in any way, shape, or form to oppression based on sexuality, gender, or sex, took time and care to explain to me the impact the book had on their thinking, their decisions, their actions. People who have lived very different lives have generously related to me similarities they recognized in these pages with their own struggles. The taste of bile, the inferno of rage, transsexual men and women, heterosexual cross-dressers and bearded females, intersexual and androgynous people, bigender and trigender individuals, and many other exquisitely defined and expressed identities. Perhaps what resonates most for me are reports that copies of Stone Butch Blues are passed around in prison cell blocks until they're worn and tattered. This book has journeyed to lands that I have not yet seen. Letters and emails have travelled to me from the tip of South America to the far reaches of the North, from Africa to Asia. The novel is translated into German and Dutch, the Chinese language edition, with a preface I wrote for readers there, has been serialised in Taiwan's leading daily newspaper, recommended as reading for teenagers and adults alike, and more translations are in the works. Has publishing this novel changed my life? Yes and no. It hasn't altered the trajectory of my life. As I finished writing Stone Butch Blues, I had already lived in the vortex of the left-wing LGBT liberation current for 30 years. I had been a revolutionary activist for more than 20 years, and a weekly journalist and editor for Workers' World newspaper. I'd fought against Pentagon wars of aggression, supported Palestinian self-determination, worked to defend political prisoners like Mumia Abu-Jamal and Leonard Peltier, been a leading organiser of the 1974 March Against Racism in Boston, toured the country in 1984 speaking about the AIDS crisis. I'd mobilised to stop the Nazis and Klan, helped protect women's reproductive rights, and made national rallies and demonstrations more accessible to deaf and disabled activists. Stonebridge Blues and the two non-fiction books I've written since, Transgender Warriors and Trans Liberation Beyond Pink or Blue, helped to create change in my life and the lives of others. But these books arose as part of waves of social struggle, contributed to their momentum, were compelled by them, and rode their curl like little surfboards. I'll leave it to historians, and herstorians to analyse the change in the decades since this novel was written, and to place the publication of Stonebridge Blues within broad and persistent social and political efforts to right societal wrongs. But with this novel, I planted a flag. Here I am. Does anyone else want to discuss these important issues? I wrote it not as an expression of individual high art, but as a working class organiser mimeographs a leaflet, a call to action. When, at my first public bookstore reading, someone asked me to sign a copy of the book for a friend who was too shy to speak to a published author, it broke my heart. My life's work is about elevating collective organising, not elevating individuals. I write this in June 2003, Pride Month, when millions across the United States and around the world are marching in the streets, cheered and applauded by millions more. Rainbow flags snap in the winds of change blowing through the streets of cities and towns, reservations and campuses. The long-term labours of our movement have wrung a great victory from a Supreme Court dominated by 7 Republicans, 6 of them appointed by Reagan and Bush Sr., which has just issued a ruling effectively decriminalising safe sex love. When the narrative of Stonebridge Blues begins, the love we made broke the law in all the states. By the time Jess finds her way to the gay drag bars, just one state had been forced to repeal that biblically named edict. Our inexorable grassroots movement has won so much in the decades this novel spans. It is the struggles of the Jesses and Edwins, Peaches and Teresas, Ruths and Duffies, then and now, that have historically been decisive. And yet there is still so much activist work to be done. My partner, Minnie Bruce, and I are packing for a brief vacation to celebrate 11 years of living and loving together. We know we will face gawks and glares. We don't know if they'll be backed up by clenched fists of rage. Those justified fears are weighty luggage to carry on a holiday. We lug them around with us every day. And we feel this Rambo mentality deepening in this epoch of endless war, colonial occupation of Iraq, and the racist roundup of Arab, Muslim, and South Asian people in this country. This is the worst of times. This is the best of times. It will be what we make of it. If I had written this novel at the dawn of the 21st century, would Jess and her friends be marching for basic LGBT civil rights? Or would they find their way into the widening struggle against capitalism, the dog-eat-dog economic system that excretes inequality and injustice as byproducts? I only know as the author that I found my way into the forefront of the movement to profoundly transform the economic and social system, and so have a generation of young freedom fighters of all sexualities, genders, sexes, and nationalities. Like the left-wing gay liberation current of the 60s and 70s, they are on the front lines of every battle for social and economic justice. From the vantage point of non-fiction and its reflection in the mercury of fiction, Jess and I share this. We both lived long enough to see quantitative resistance transformed into qualitative collective fight back. The 1969 Stonewall Uprising ignited a massive movement in the streets from coast to coast and around the world. It was the second great international surge demanding sexual and gender liberation in the 20th century, and it was woven with a thousand threads to the historic liberation movements of African Americans and Latinos, Asian and Native peoples, women, and the upsurge against the Vietnam War. Stone Butch Blues is a bridge of memory, the immense human toll of the AIDS epidemic and of oppression as a whole have created a gaping chasm, virtually generations lost. As a result, the history of social movements and their lessons are episodically recalled. Recovering collective memory is itself an act of struggle. It allows the generational currents of the white-capped river of our movement to flow together, the awesome roar of our many waters. And the course of our movement is not fixed in its banks like the Hudson River. It is ours to determine, from Selma to Stonewall to Seattle. We who believe in freedom will not rest until every battle is won. I am typing these words as June 2003 surges with pride. What year is it now as you read them? What has been won? What has been lost? I can't see from here. I can't predict. But I know this. You are experiencing the impact of what we in the movement take a stand on and fight for today. The present and past are the trajectory of the future. But the arc of history does not bend towards justice automatically. As the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass said, without struggle, there is no progress. I can say this with certainty. If your life is being ground up in economic machinery and the burden of oppression is heavy on your back, you hunger for liberation, and so do those around you. Look for our brightly coloured banners coming up over the hill of the past and into your present. Listen for our voices, our protest chants drawing nearer. Join us in the front ranks. We are marching toward liberation. That's what the characters of Stonebridge Blues fought for. The last chapter of the saga of struggle has not yet been written. Leslie Feinberg.